today, who is gaslighting who? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. The Senate estimates process is always worth a watch, as it can be more spicy than the lower house version. This is where entities from the RBA through to Treasury and other government departments are questioned by senators. This past week, we had the RBA on the stand following the recent rate rise in the release of the latest statement on monetary policy. That document is a summary of many of the RBA's modelling assumptions and does contain some forecasts which are conditioned on, for example, current market interest rate expectations, assumptions about productivity growth or lack of it, which are anemic, of course, at the moment, and government spending at the federal and state level, as well as credit momentum. One big question is, of course, the impact of current policy settings on households. And in this exchange, Senator Canavan raised the apparent gap between the governor's view that the economy was okay compared with the impact on real households at the moment.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to go to the statement on monetary policy and particularly the table at the back of it, the real wage price index. My reading of your forecast here is that even by, while there is some growth in real wages by the end of the forecast period, real wages will remain below where they are today through to mid-2028. Is that correct?
You've got to be a little bit careful just using the wage price index for that, because the wage price index doesn't actually measure what people are being paid, because it doesn't include things like job changes, promotions, sure, bonuses, those sorts of things. So okay, if well, you actually look at real wages,
that's the best measure we've got. Right. But over that forecast period, they'll still be below, won't they?
But I'm not sure it's the best measure we have.
No. What's the best measure you have?
And the national accounts measure is a much broader measure that
you don't offer forecasts of that then.
And those numbers, I think they're still rising.
That's what the nominal average earnings per hour are referring
to. That's nominal, not real then, is it?
Yeah, but the wage price index is nominal as well, so you have to
How can the real wage price index be nominal if it's called a real wage index?
No, the one here is the nominal wage price index growth. Yeah,
and on that table, under income, wage price index, that's the nominal wage price index.
All right, I'm getting confused. Is it after inflation, I suppose?
No.
It's not a measure of real wages then. Because colloquially,
he's looking at this one.
Oh, sorry.
The one you should be looking at is real average earnings per hour.
Right.
Right, which is rising.
Which does start rising.
But
the real wage index actually...
Yes, but that doesn't, as I said, measure what people actually earn.
Well, has there been a period where... I mean, that index is now back to 2011 levels. Finish my question? You're very defensive at this point. I mean, has there ever been a period in Australian economic history where we haven't had an increase in the real wage index for 17 years? In fact, it will still be quite a lot below.
Take that on notice. We have graphs on the real wage. I'd have to try and find it.
I'm just trying to wonder. So real wages are back to 2011 levels today. I've gone back 15 years. And, Governor, you said before the economy is okay. I'm just trying to square your statement that the economy is okay with how the feedback I get as a representative of people, that they're really struggling. So when you say the economy is okay, are you not taking into account how much people are struggling right now with the way living standards have dropped by something we've never seen before?
On the contrary, we do understand that not everyone is doing well.
Well, I would put you, it's not everyone, it's almost everyone is not doing well.
Well,
when you've got that kind of drop.
If you go to, graph 2.7, which is household disposable income growth. And what that shows you is that over the past couple of years, real household disposable incomes have been rising.
Right.
That's what that tells you.
Where are they back to levels they were before COVID?
If you look at the AENA measure of real income per hour worked,
above. Well, this is, I mean, part of the problem, you keep jumping around the different stats. I just asked, is real disposable incomes back to where it was before COVID?
Our preferred measure, yes, they're above.
Real disposable income?
I believe it would be, but we'd have to take that on notice. Can I just make a point? Can I just make an important point here?
It seems to me whenever there's something that might be negative, you take on notice, and then you try and jump to a different measure when you want to say positive. Well, I suppose people listening might get pretty frustrated because certainly people don't feel like they're better off right now.
But can I answer your question about these different measures?
Yeah.
The wage price index currently, in real terms, is not much higher than it was in 2010. That's not on that measure.
That's right.
And so
I would
agree with you there.
That's okay, good. So
and then it's the real measure of average earnings from the national accounts, which is not disposable income because it doesn't take out taxes and so on, has increased over that period. The increase, though, is relatively modest, which is a reflection of what we talked about on productivity.
Yeah, look, and thank you for that, because it would be, I think people are only going to get angrier in this country if they're gaslit into thinking that the economy is okay when their lived experience is absolutely terrible.
Senator,
I take exception
to that comment. I am not gaslighting anyone.
Let us speak.
I have said that there are certain aspects of the economy which are doing well, and one of them is the labour market, which is positive for people. Now, I understand that some people are doing it tough. I do understand. I get letters and I read them. But that is not to say that you can't recognise that there are some parts of the economy that are doing well. And the labour market, I think, has been a really positive thing for this country.
Well, I'm only my response, Governor, was to the comment that the economy is okay. You didn't say that some people
are doing well.
You said the economy is okay, and I cannot see on these numbers if the economy. What is the economy about? The economy is about, in my view, the reason we care about it is for people's basic ability to provide for themselves, and that has gone backwards at a rate that we have never seen in Australian economic history.
And I am saying that you're thinking okay means it's great. Okay means it's okay. We aren't growing. I've already made this point. We are not growing strongly. We can't grow strongly because we don't have strong productivity growth. That is not a good thing. But people at least have jobs at the moment. There is the unemployment rate is at typically not historic low levels, but at pretty low levels, and that is a positive thing.
But if the labour market was so good, why aren't wages growing?
Well, wages, it depends.
Again, people
on
care.
On your measure. Yep. Right? You are looking at wage price index. We are looking at a measure of what people are actually being paid. Now, it's not shooting the lights out either, but it is above where it was pre-COVID.
So I don't know if people think the labour market is that great either, because, again, I would have thought the Labor Party and the Labor government would want a good labour market to be one where people's living standards are increasing, when their wages are going up. And they haven't been under this government. They've fallen. They're behind.
Got to have a job.
They've gone
first,
backwards.
Get wages.
They've gone backwards.
Got to have a job.
And that's just a fact.
You'll get your job, Senator O'Neill.
So, is the government's budget in structural deficit at the moment?
I'm not the best person to answer that question.
But does the RBA evaluate the structural position of the
government? We take Treasury's and others' measures
but
of these
sorts of
things.
Do you factor in the structural settings of the budget to monetary policy decisions?
We put public demand into our forecasts for what demand is going to be, aggregate demand, and we factor that into our forecasts for inflation.
Well, okay, I'll just... Treasury does provide an estimate of it in chart 3.13 from MyEFO on page 88, I thought. Yep, 88. The structural deficit here, it's off a graph, so I can only estimate it, but it would appear to be in the order of around 1.5%, negative 1.5% actually increasing this financial year. Does that accord with the inputs that the RBA would use to its decision?
We would use those inputs.
There's a large structural budget deficit.
We would use those inputs.
So a structural deficit would indicate that fiscal policy is expansionary at the moment?
It depends on the direction it's going.
But it's increasing on this graph.
If you've got, I think
right.
we've
so
got
that
a
means
graph
it's expansionary.
I think we've got a graph in the Statement of Monetary Policy that shows if you go on the forecasts, what happens is that it's expansionary and then it starts
so to... So it is expansionary at the moment?
It's rising, okay. So therefore okay. the changes...
So an expansionary fiscal policy would put upward pressure on interest rates, all other things being equal. Is
expansionary,
that right?
we've been in this before. If if public demand is increasing, then it's increasing demand
right, so, but
in
I just,
total. And
I know why you don't want to go. The problem is because you get very defensive, and then I thought you're independent. So these are very simple things. So yes, we've established there's a structural deficit. We've established that's increasing. We've established that's expansionary. Expansionary fiscal policy puts upward pressure on interest rates, does it not?
Depends on what happens with private demand.
Ceteris paribus, right? Ceteris paribus. If private demand stays the same, an expansionary fiscal policy will push upward pressure on interest rates.
That's mathematically
She's an economist.
It's mathematically correct.
Yes, thank you. It's economically correct.
If you are in a situation of excess demand and you add more demand, doesn't matter where it comes from.
Just
upward pressure on inflation.
Thank you. We've got there. So, limited time left. Has the Reserve Bank increased its estimate of the Nairu?
Our models, estimates of Nairu have been rising a bit.
Okay.
But we don't take a model approach only. We also use a bit of judgment, and we've got some information in the new. The most recent Statement of Monetary Policy, which talks about our approach to thinking about the tightness of the labour market.
So what's the current estimate of the Naira?
Our current estimate, 3.6, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Order. And have you lowered potential growth? Can I just ask one quick question?
What's the last one?
4.6, sorry, apologies.
Okay, sorry. Have you lowered potential growth forecasts?
Our potential growth, we think, is a little bit lower than it was. We thought it was probably middle of last year.
Okay, all right. I have lots of more questions, but I'm not given much time. So,
thank you, Senator Hume.
Now, the missing part of this argument was, of course, the impact of higher taxation on households, which has been growing much faster than businesses, plus the fact that more households now have multiple jobs, and so income growth is up, as the wage price index, therefore, is at odds with the average household income. And as we saw, one is falling while the other is rising. Actually, recently CBA noted that despite our expectation for a lift in household expenditure to a more trend-like pace, as the cash rate is normalised, there will be a natural handbrake on the pace of consumption growth. First, the positive impact on household income from the Stage 3 tax cuts will fade, as no personal tax cuts are legislated in the 25-26 financial year. Indeed, they said, we will return to the world of fiscal drag, given marginal tax rates are not indexed in Australia. Tax payments by households as a share of household income will start to lift again without another round of personal income tax cuts or genuine tax reform. Second, they say, the tailwind of the notional drawdown of pandemic savings has largely run its course. This drawdown partially offset the impact of significantly higher interest rates on household consumption over the past 3 years. Oh, and third, real wages growth is likely to be only around 0.5% over the next few years. They define that as the average spread on our forecast between the annual change in the wage price index and trimmed mean inflation. Now, all of this highlights the importance of government spending growth, funded, of course, by higher taxation. This is the debate about public versus private demand, which has been in the spotlight, with the Treasurer suggesting the momentum in the economy is accelerating thanks to private demand, but simply spending by the private sector, compared with government spending.
It's about the table on page 4 of your recent statement on monetary policy, the February statement on monetary policy.
Page 4?
Yeah, I believe it's the overview table.
Yep.
So as I understand it, based on your latest forecasts, even with an additional 1 to 2 rate increases, because they're priced in, you don't quite get back to the midpoint of the target band for inflation within the 2.5-year mm-hmm. horizon. Mm-hmm. That's correct?
That's what that says, yes, because 2.5
is the midpoint of the target. Yep. And I'm reading this right, so that you've got the cash rate going to also 4.2 at the end of the forecast period. It's currently 3.85, so that's a 35 basis point increase. So
that's a technical assumption, yes.
Yes, okay. But even so, if you assume that the cash rate goes up, we still don't get back to the midpoint of the inflation.
That's what the central forecast says.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then on the GDP forecasts, so I noticed that there's been a significant downgrade of those, at least if you get beyond the middle of this year, you know, down to 1.6%.
It's been an upgrade in the near term and then a downgrade in the out year, which reflects the higher interest rate profile and the higher exchange rate.
Okay. Is that, I mean, I did read this somewhere, so I just wanted to check, but is 1.6, I mean, is that the slowest growth at the end of a forecasting horizon that the RBA has produced?
It's actually, I don't believe it is. I think our November 22 forecasts had a lower growth rate than that.
Okay. But it's pretty low outside of recession.
It's pretty low outside of a recession.
And so you touched on this earlier, but what were the drivers in your forecasting framework that have driven that downgrade? You mentioned exchange rate movements.
The two things that have changed between the November forecasts and here, the main things that are driving this different profile are the stronger near term, because as I said, we were surprised on the upside on a few things. But the higher cash rate path and the higher exchange rate, because, you know, the higher exchange rate also tightens things up, puts downward pressure on inflation and the economy. Those two things are helping to drive the growth rate back down, again, below the rate of growth of supply, because, again, as I said earlier, we've got a situation, we've got excess demand, and that's what helps to close the gap and bring inflation back down into the band.
Okay. But just to my layperson's understanding, I mean, we've got the economy growing, say, in December 2027 at 1.6%, but inflation, trimmed mean inflation, still outside the target band. So that suggests to me that the speed limit of the economy now is below 2%. The economy can't grow.
Well, that's sort of our productivity assumptions for the short term, for the period we forecast. Yes, productivity is only growing by about 0.7, I think, in our forecast, which means that, yes, the supply side of the economy is probably only growing by about 2. And that's part of the challenge. Unless we can improve productivity, we're going to find it hard to grow much more than 2% a year without having inflationary issues.
Okay. Right, I understand. So unless we can get productivity above 0.7%, which is your long-run forecast?
It's not our long-run forecast, okay. It's our short-run. We only forecast it for the... It's not really a forecast, it's an assumption based on what we've been observing in terms of actual productivity outcomes plus, quite frankly, the inflation and the unit labour cost outcomes.
Okay. So unless we can get productivity moving higher, though, the growth rate is likely to stay around 2.
Productivity is all about producing more with the same amount of good, the same amount of labour and capital, and that's what raises living standards.
Yes.
So if you can't get productivity increasing more quickly, then you can't grow the economy and you can't raise living standards as quickly.
Okay. Thank you. There's been a difference historically in the productivity performance between the public sector and the private sector, right?
Yes, okay. But there are, I think, not only the public and the private sector, but different sectors of the economy, there's actually massive differences in productivity.
Yes.
In levels and in growth rates.
Okay, understood.
And in the ability to measure it accurately.
And that was the other point.
Okay. Well, I guess I was just getting to the point. Is there some truth in the statement or in the view that because the lower productivity parts of the economy have been growing more quickly, lower productivity sectors, than the more productive parts, and that's predominantly public sector versus private sector, our overall productivity performance has declined?
So our analysis actually doesn't suggest that that is the main part of what's going on. There is some impact of that. There is a measurement issue, as Chris was referring to, in that for many parts of particularly the service, the non-market service area, so I'm thinking about things like healthcare and aged care and those sorts of things, where we have seen growth in those areas. Outputs are measured by inputs, so by definition there is no productivity growth over time.
Mm-hmm.
It can't account for quality, it can't, so by definition you just don't get any productivity growth. But it's fair to, so our analysis suggests that there's a little bit of that, but that's not the main game. And you only have to look overseas to see similar declines in productivity over time. The US is an exception. Most other countries, over the decades, productivity growth has slowed. And, you know, we're no different. It's true that we have not had any productivity growth over the last probably 10 years. Productivity level is probably about where it was pre-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
It's had lots of big wiggles in the middle. I discourage people from looking at quarterly changes in productivity. You've got to think about it in a slightly more long-run sense. But it is concerning that it hasn't grown since pre-COVID. And as I said earlier, it's really important that we get productivity growth in all areas of the economy if we can. As I said, our analysis suggests that this market, non-market thing you're referring to, that's not the main game.
Okay, thank you. Just the United States, because you raised that. So the fact that they've had or continue to have a better productivity performance means their economy is able to grow more quickly without triggering inflation, which is what we've seen now over the last 3 to 4 years.
Yes, although they've had an inflation problem too, and they still have an inflation problem.
Yes.
Yes, they have had strong productivity growth, and they're the standout, I think, aren't they, Chris?
Yeah.
Amongst advanced economies.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
You've got 2 minutes, Senator.
Okay, sorry, last question. So just going back to the inflation, the model, the page four table there. So as I said, we've got... The assumption is that the cash rate goes up by 35-45 basis points, but inflation, trimmed mean inflation, still remains above the midpoint of the target.
Mm-hmm.
So is it fair to say that we will need additional rate rises to bring trimmed mean inflation back to the midpoint of the target, everything else being equal?
So that's the central forecast. What it actually means... that's not clear. It might, but it might not. I would refer you to graph 3.6 of the statement, which is on page 53, which gives you a fan chart, which shows you historical errors of forecasts. So the board, in its approach, is not saying that this is the rate path it's going to take.
Yes.
It's cautious, and as we saw back, you know, middle of last year, we thought inflation was coming back into the band, and it hasn't. So forecasts are fallible. Don't read that the interest rate path we've got in there is the interest rate path we have to have. It might be, but it might not be.
Mm.
And hence why the board say that they are going to be continually looking at the data, tells us where we are, and what that means for our forecast going forward, and we will be continually reassessing that. If we need to go up further because inflation is entrenched, the board will do so, because that is its primary mandate.
Yeah, OK. Now, look, I understand these are forecasts, but, I mean, as I read Table 4, the outlook is for growth below 2%, inflation above the midpoint of the target band, higher interest rate rises and declining real wages out to the middle of 2028.
It's not a nice picture, but... I do want to inject one positive thing here, and that is the labour market. I think everyone's been focusing on the negatives, but we're in this position because the economy is actually doing okay. It can't grow really strongly because productivity's not growing, but the labour market is holding up. It's still a little bit tight, and this is good news. And in fact, it's much better news than some other countries overseas have seen with their labour markets.
No intention of prosecuting any of the discussions that went, that obviously you appeared before the House Economics Committee last week, and we don't want to make you repeat yourselves. But I did notice in your press conference following the most recent rise that you've responded, Governor, to a question on four occasions by saying that you don't comment on fiscal policy and that fiscal policy is not your business and that we work with what we've got. I perfectly understand that. But I want to just unpack that a little bit. Is that right then to interpret this as the RBA having a general policy of not commenting on fiscal policy?
I don't believe that our job is to tell the government or the parliament what to do with fiscal policy. That is a matter. Fiscal policy, as I've said on a number of occasions, is about providing goods and services and infrastructure for the Australian economy. That is the purview of the parliament and the government. It is not the Reserve Bank's role to comment on what governments and parliaments should be doing, where they should be spending their money.
I understand exactly the position you're coming from. I suppose, however, it is also fair to say that fiscal policy can be a driver of inflation, can have a significant impact on inflation, even if you don't comment about it.
It can. If, as I said at the House of Representatives last week, it is part of aggregate demand. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a situation like we are at the moment, where we have excess demand, private and public are both part of demand.
Yes.
So, yes, mathematically, it is a fact that that is the case.
So I just want to be very clear on this. As a general rule, the RBA does not comment on fiscal policy, but it is wrong to assume that just because the RBA hasn't mentioned fiscal policy or doesn't comment on fiscal policy, that it didn't have an effect on your decision, because it does contribute to aggregate demand, as you say, which is something that the RBA bases its decisions on.
If you're talking about our most recent decision, our most recent decision was based on the fact that aggregate demand is, we think, in excess of the ability of the economy to supply those goods and services. Both public and private contribute to that. But what I would say is that if you look at the difference between our forecasts in November and at where we had inflation coming back into the band, and you look at our forecast now, where inflation isn't, the key difference there is not fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much the same as it was in November. The key difference is private demand.
Yes. Mm-hmm. OK. I hear you, and I've got some questions about that. I suppose what I'm trying to understand is that the Treasurer said that fiscal policy was not a factor in the decision that you took. Now, clearly, that is not the case. Just because you don't talk about fiscal policy doesn't mean you endorse fiscal policy. That would be an awkward position to be in,
wouldn't it? We don't endorse, we don't advocate, we don't do anything.
Thank you.
For fiscal policy.
So it's reasonable to conclude that on the basis of the fact that it wasn't mentioned in the accompanying release, that government spending has no bearing on your decision making. Of course it does, because of its contribution to aggregate demand.
So yes, and I've said that before, and I have nothing more to add on that.
Thank you.
Now, as the RBA says, the aggregate demand, that's the sum of the two, the public and the private, is higher than the economy's ability to deliver, leading to higher inflation, which therefore demanded the recent rate rise. But despite attempts from senators to get the RBA to directly confirm stronger government spending and structural deficits leads to higher inflation, Michelle Bullock dodged the question, saying that's a fiscal, meaning government issue, not an RBA issue. They simply take the spending figures as inputs into their modelling. Now, of course, this is a political hot potato. But here is another angle, the composition of jobs growth. And here we should note, as Matt Barry shared on X, the bulk, around 80%, is from the non-market sector, meaning directly or indirectly funded by government.
They're predominantly, they're considered non-market because they're predominantly government.
They're reliant on government funding.
So they're not good jobs, is that right?
So the jobs wouldn't exist without government funding, is that right?
Not all of them. So there are some, for instance, in some of this stuff, like in education, there'll be private health, there'll be private schools, employment in private schools in that, for example.
Mm. Okay. So how many government jobs have been created in the last year?
Uh,
government
put across the country, across because it's reporting employment across the country, as you'd understand.
So in terms of 1.2%,
in terms of public jobs, it's to the September quarter 2024, it's about 1.2% growth over the year.
And of a proportion of overall employment growth?
As a proportion, so private was 1.8, 1.8% growth.
40% is public.
So about in terms of shares, about 40% is public.
40% is public?
Yep.
Okay, so 40% of the employment growth in the last year, you're saying, is government-funded jobs?
40% represents the public, well, how the ABS defines public, yeah.
Which is separate from how you just define non-market?
That's correct. Right, yeah.
So to use your non-market definition, how big would that be?
Non-market would be 83%.
83%?
Yep.
So 83% of the employment growth in the last year, non-market jobs?
Yes.
Wowzers. Okay. Is that does that concern you?
I think we've seen from a number of years there's shortages in the care economy and those related ones. So this is it looks like a recalibration that's coming through.
Okay. Well, just to be clear, the definition of non-market is largely government supported.
Non-market includes education and training, healthcare, social assistance, as well as public administration and safety. So it'll be all those three.
Okay, so is it a true to label non-market? They're not market jobs, they exist because of public subsidisation.
Sorry, I missed that question. Sorry, Senator.
Sorry. So is it a true to label sticker in the sense that these roles wouldn't exist in the market without some sort of government substitution or subsidisation? That's why you call them non-market jobs. Is that right?
So they're certainly jobs that are supported by government provision, by right. government support. However, it would depend on the nature of those entities, the businesses, how they interact. Some non-market provision can still be coming through a non-supported position, like my colleague said before.
So standing back, we see a stark truth. The current government settings are allowing for higher spending by federal government and the states, of course, are joining in. That's being funded by higher taxes, which are expected to grow further, with a bigger impulse on households at the aggregate level than interest rate hikes, although that too now will impact some borrowing households significantly, and we do expect more rate hikes ahead. The government says it's trying to put downward pressure on inflation in its own ways. Trouble, of course, is that any payment or subsidy handed to a household has the potential to increase demand in the economy and so fuel inflation. Treasurer Jim Chalmers has repeatedly said his cost of living relief has been targeted to help low-income families while not adding to inflation. But actually, he needn't bother defending his huge cash splash on financially vulnerable Australians because a bigger force is providing a far bigger handbrake on the household demand. That, of course, is taxation. Here's the inconvenient truth. Without the indexation of income tax brackets, that is, tax brackets moving higher with incomes, revenues have been supercharged by a stronger than expected economy and inflation. And so that gives the government more fiscal space to spend even more. And as I've been banging on for some time, this government is a big spending government. But of course, the question is the money being spent in the right places? Well, the current settings are inflationary. More households are going to find it harder to get along. As I discussed earlier in the week, household financial pressures are continuing to build. But it's by design. Which begs the question then, well, so who is actually gaslighting who? I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.